with that, I'm going to introduce Kylie, who's going to actually be speaking for us tomorrow, and she's going to read the theme for us for tonight.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Kylie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kylie.
This is our theme for this weekend, and this is from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 164. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. And I will turn it over to Stacy, who I think is going to introduce our speaker, Ashley, tonight.
Hello, I'm Stacy. I am an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to introduce Ashley. I was in a very transitioning place in my life, in my career, with my job in January, and just kind of stuck in Northern Michigan, felt very stuck in Northern Michigan. And my sponsor said, well, how do you get fed? And I said, well, I get fed by conferences. And she said, well, go to a conference. And it was, I literally booked a plane flight in a week and flew to Bismarck, North Dakota in January for Rule 62. Why? Everybody's like, you're going to Bismarck, North Dakota in January for a big, what is wrong? You know, anyway. But it was an amazing conference. It's every year. We need to talk about that some more, because it's going to probably go on in January. And so it's an amazing conference. And part of the conference is that most of the meals are included at this resort in Bismarck. And so it's all everybody together, right? Like it's all everybody together. And so there was just two seats and it was Ashley and I, and we got to, didn't meet her before, didn't know who she was, but we had a random breakfast together in January at this conference in North Dakota when it was negative 18 outside. It wasn't that cold, but it felt that cold. And we've been kicking it ever since, man. We're just chilling and being friends and we're in the middle. And so that's how this stuff happens, you know, is just friends you haven't met yet. And, I know she's sponsored. I know she's sponsored well. I know she walks this program. And then I give you Ashley.
Thank you, Stacy. My name is Ashley Patzner, and I am an alcoholic. Want to thank the committee and God, of course, for drawing my name out of a hat. I do have a sobriety date. That day is December the 13th of 2017. I do have a sponsor. And I sponsor women. My home group is the Bismarck Three Legacies group. We meet here in Bismarck on Thursday nights at 7 p.m. if you're ever in the area, and we're back to meeting in person. We'd love to have you. Super nervous right now. So I'll just start from the beginning. You know, I was born in North Dakota. I was born in Jamestown. I have one older brother, and I was born into a dysfunctional alcoholic home, right? And that's all I knew. And from that point on, you know, that is what I thought normal was. Both my mom and my dad were alcoholics and drug addicts. And that's just kind of the kind of environment that I grew up in. It was very normal that there was parties all throughout the week at our house. And I remember very young, right? I would watch my dad, you know, when he'd have parties over at the house on the weekends, and I couldn't wait for the weekend, right? Because my dad was more fun. He was better to be around, you know, he wasn't so cranky. I could go out in the kitchen and sing Shania Twain on the karaoke machine and, you know, laugh with my dad and, you know, my uncles while they drink beer. And I seen that it did something for them. And so from a very young age, that's ultimately what my life looked like. You know, and there's, as far back as I can remember, you know, I believe I had the spiritual malady far before I ever picked up a drink. And the best way that I can explain that, right, is I always lived in this thing is as if I had this, I would be okay. And what I had was never enough. And at like 6 years old, my parents wouldn't get me something I wanted at Walmart. So I made it seem like they were kidnapping me. And that would be the story throughout the rest of my life, right? Absolutely fighting to get my way. And ultimately playing God long before I even knew what that was or how I did that. I always wanted to be somewhere else, doing something else. You know, my skin never fit. And I'd watch my parents, right? Because there was a lot of, you know, physical, emotional, and mental abuse, right, within the family. And I'd watch my parents, and I'm like, if this is what it's going to be like when I grow up, I don't want nothing to do with it. And later to know that I would sacrifice those morals and values the further that I got into alcoholism. My mom and my dad ended up splitting up around age, I think it was around 8, you know, my mom had remarried, and remarried to another alcoholic. So, you know, it was the same story, different face. And we moved away. I was a huge dad's girl. You know, I was listening to one of the speakers earlier, and she said that her first God was her dad. And that resonated with me, right? Because that was my guy. And he still is today, right? He means the world to me, and I hold him on this pedestal. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I was separated from my dad, and we moved to a little town. I'm in North Dakota, Minto, North Dakota. It's about a town, about 500 people. And I was torn away from my friends and, you know, stuck in this community, right? And it's a small town. I wasn't a small town girl. I was used to, you know, the Bismarck, Mandan area. And we moved up there. And around that time, you know, my grandpa was passing away. You know, my stepdad had committed suicide and some other things had happened, right, that I just didn't know how to deal with. You know, and I'd watch my mom and I'd watch my dad, and I'd see how these things would do something for them, right? So by age 9, you know, I'm smoking cigarettes, and I have my first drink. And I had the immediate consequences, right? And what it did for me in that moment was it absolutely lit me up. And I could fall into the river and laugh about it. And I felt like I fit in with you. And I could just be, right? Because, you know, every other time in my life, I'm hustling for your worthiness. And if I think you want me to be a certain way in order to get your approval, you know, I will be that chameleon wherever I go. So I had that first drink, and it was like my skin fit, right? I could finally exhale. And, you know, I'd snuck out of the house that night. My brother told my mom on me. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting woken up and she's like, you're going to clean the house. And I'm puking. I don't feel good. And I'm like, you know, I don't know about this. But I would sit there and I'd be like, if I just have to throw up a little bit, you know, not feel so good for a little while, you know, I'm going to do this as often as I can. And at that age, alcohol wasn't exactly easy to get. And so I would seek outside issues, and that would become a part of my story. Around age 9, once I started drinking, you know, and I'd watch from a very, you know, watch from my family that when things didn't go your way, or if someone offended you or hurt you, that you reacted in violence. And that was how I dealt with my problems. So at age 9, I get in trouble for beating a girl up. And I think that's normal, right? If someone says something you don't like, you just hit them. The court system would say otherwise. So by age 10, I was on juvenile probation. And, you know, after my stepdad's suicide, you know, it was, I'd do it every chance I could get. eventually, after I got into all that trouble, you know, we moved back to Bismarck. And, you know, I lived with my mom. I think I maybe seen my dad once the year and a half I was gone. And that was extremely difficult for me. My dad was active in alcoholism. So I went over there when, you know, mom got hard. So we moved back to Bismarck. And my mom quits everything, right? And there was things that my brother was getting away with, still in her car, whatever the case may be, that I'm no longer getting away with. And at this point, I'm seeing, you know, a psychiatrist because my mom thinks something's wrong with me. That if I could just get the right medication, maybe I wouldn't act out so bad. And so we move back and my mom stops everything, you know, and she becomes extremely hard on me. And what started to happen is at this point, I'm in sixth grade. I'm getting in more physical altercations because that's the only way I know how to deal with my problems. If I can't put something into my body, I deal with them through violence. And I'm coming home drunk and my mom's like, okay, we're going to give you one of two choices. Either you're going to go to the cops or the cops are going to come here. And I had a lot of those, you know, manipulative and self-seeking behaviors long before I ever picked up that drink. And what I would do is I'd be like, well, have them come here then. I'd go into the bathroom and I'd chug a bottle of mouthwash. Little did I know that bottle of mouthwash had alcohol in it. So I was blowing way more than what I was actually under the influence for. And my mom had absolutely no idea what to do with me. You know, my mom would give me these consequences, parenting me the best way she knew how, right? And I would look at her like she was the devil. I'm like, you hate me. You don't want me to have any fun. So then I'd run over to my dad's. And my dad was a party type. I could do whatever I wanted over at his house. And I continued to do that. Eventually, you know, I'm in and out of a youth work shelter. I'm consistently on juvenile probation at this point. And that's what my life is. And I thought it was normal. And when I was 13, you know, it was always like suicide was always on the table for me. And when I couldn't get my way, I threatened to commit suicide. And that goes back to me, you know, I will do whatever I can and be whoever you want me to be in order to get my way. And I don't care how it makes you feel. But if you have something I want, I will absolutely run you over. And that was a very common theme throughout my life. So around, you know, 14, by that point, I had already been in inpatient treatment, a very common theme for me. I'd pick up these minors and these charges, and I'd go run and check myself into treatment because if I can make everything look really good on the outside, then that will prevent external consequences. And it did for a long time. You know, if there was any way I could manipulate the situation and go around it, I definitely did. And so when I'm 14, you know, drinking it's on the weekends. And I was always fond of school, right? And it's like the deeper that I got into this thing, those things easily got pushed aside. And it was, this is what I'm going to do. And I was okay with it. Skipping around a little bit, around 16, I got a DUI. And at that point in my life, I'm a sophomore in high school and I'm drinking every opportunity I can get. And I didn't care about the consequences at that point. It was whatever I could get to feel this hole inside of me because I was never okay. And anything that I ever did, it was never enough. And so around 16, I'm drinking before school. You know, I'm leaving my lunch breaks and I'm drinking during school. You know, at the high school that I was going to at the time, they had an option for detention. That if you go pick up trash around the community, you can get double the time. And what I would do during that time is I would walk down to my friend's house and I would drink vodka and pour her trash in my trash bag and go back to school and get double the time. And that's what I did, right? And it got to a point where it's like they're randomly calling in police officers to sobriety test me. And I was okay with it, right? Because it's, the consequences at that point didn't matter. I thought I was invincible. You know, my parents I could often manipulate them into getting me out of situations, whether it be checking me out of inpatient treatment or whatever the case was. And so I picked that DUI up and I'm 16 years old. And it was terrifying, right? And I'd come through with these experiences and it'd be like, I'm not going to do that again, right? And there was many times in my story where, you know, I'd go to treatment and I'd be like, I'm done, right? And I'm not going to do this anymore. And I'd get out and I'd ultimately go back to what I knew. And I was absolutely unwilling to do anything else. And so I get this DUI. You know, I had drank for a substantial amount of time. I don't remember getting in my car, but I remember coming out of a blackout and there was a cop behind me. I had my car door open and the cop asked me what I was doing. And I don't remember much of the conversation, but I remember at one point I said, just take me to jail, I'm drunk. I had no idea how long I'd been driving for, if I'd killed someone. And that was extremely scary, right? But fear will never keep me sober, you know, and it might sober me up for a little bit of time. But ultimately, if I don't have a solution in between that, I'm going back to what I know. And so I did. On my 17th birthday, at this point, you know, I have an extensive juvenile history. My probation officer has no idea what to do with me. Because no matter what I do, right, I'm not stopping. You know, I'm failing UAs. I'm getting curfew citations, stealing my mom's car, whatever the case is. And so they give me two options. They're like, either you can go through the juvenile drug court program or you can go out to the youth correctional center. And I'm all about taking the option that I might be able to continue to do what I'm doing, right? As long as I manipulate a way to do it. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll go through the juvenile drug court program. I was accepted. And what happened on my 17th birthday was I got an ankle bracelet put on me and I was put on house arrest. In that program, they put a breathalyzer machine in my house that I called every 6 to 8 hours. And I did that. I had a tracker come into my house randomly. And I'm still unable to stay sober. You know, I can string together a week or 2 weeks. But ultimately, I'm doing whatever I can to not feel the way I feel. Because when I am stone sober, I cannot stand the way it feels to be in my own skin. And I would seek outside issues, right? And I'd continue to do that. And I didn't care how it made me feel as long as I didn't have to feel what it felt to be me inside. And I had no idea what that was, you know. I had no idea that that was the spiritual malady of my disease. And so I'm doing this and I'm in drug court and they're sticking me back into treatment. And I'm coming, you know, and I do well when I'm in treatment. I can conform and confine. The model inmate put me in any secure facility and I can do it. It's when I get out of those that I have absolutely no idea how to cope with life on life's terms. And so I come home on, a pass, and I use, and I go back and I'm just like, I can't get this right. And at that point, I believe I was completely unwilling to do anything else. I used the excuse for a long time that I'm just having fun. I lived in the delusion that I'm not hurting anyone but myself. Little did I know that my parents were staying up day out and day in, whatever. That my parents are staying up at night, right, wondering if their daughter's okay. Is she going to be alive? And I had absolutely no regards for anyone but myself. At that point, you know, I'm still in high school. And I always told myself since I was a little girl, right, that I'm going to be the first woman to graduate high school. And I meant it, right? And I have these morals and these values and these ambitions, right, that this is what I'm going to do. And I am incapable of doing those things left to my own devices. And so the further that I get into my alcoholism, school gets put on the back burner. All of a sudden, I'm not showing up anymore. I got kicked out of that high school for fighting. And so I went to the other high school. And at that point, you know, I'm in the juvenile drug court program. I'm going to school with alcohol on my breath. I have this alcohol machine in my house, and I'm finding a way to manipulate that. And eventually, there was no way that I was going to pass my senior year of high school. Absolutely no way. I couldn't show up for school. And even when I was, I'd pay people to do my homework. And so I drop out of that school and I enroll in an alternative school. I was in that alternative school for about 2 weeks, right? And then I go into my weekly meeting for drug court and they revocate me. There's nothing else that we can do for you. We're sending you out to the youth correctional center. At that point, I'm 18 years old. And I get out there on December 21st of 2013. And, again, I conform and confine. And I was out there for a period of 5 months. And what started to happen is I met someone who told me the truth for the first time in my life. And she was my counselor or my case manager. And I absolutely despised her because for the first time in my life, someone could see through the mask and the facade that I was putting on and told me the truth. And what started to happen while I was in there is I conform and confine. And I think I'm doing the right things. And I think I have the right motives. But ultimately, I have this idea in the back of my mind that when I get out, I'm not gonna be under supervision. You know, no one's no longer going to be able to tell me how I need to live my life. And I don't think I, you know, there was a little part of me that thought maybe there was a problem. Because every time I picked up alcohol, I never knew when I was going to stop. And I knew that about me. And I knew that I drank differently. And I knew that I always had consequences. But the price of being the way that I felt when I was sober with no solution was worth those consequences that I knew I was going to get. I end up graduating high school out there. I do extremely well. The model inmate, right? I got in trouble once when I was out there. And I got the opportunity to speak at my graduation out there. And had alcoholism not taken me to such a point, I would have never graduated high school. So I had the opportunity to speak at this high school. Right. And I'm determined and it's like, I'm going to do this. Right. But I have absolutely no idea that I don't have the power. And I, you know, I apply to some colleges, I get accepted with, you know, a full year and grants and scholarships. And, you know, I get out and I do good for a little bit. And that's a very common theme, right? Is I can do good for a while. And I get out and I get my classes and my books and I'm enrolled in the University of Mary, and I'm going to go into psychology. And at this point, you know, I don't have any felonies on my record, and I can do something with my life, and I can make something of myself. About 2 weeks before school started, I went back to what I knew, you know, and I started drinking. And eventually outside issues became a bigger part of my story at that point. And I never made it to that first day of school. And I was too ashamed to withdraw from my classes, and I was too ashamed to go to the second day. And, you know, it got worse from there. And I eventually made it off of that probation. But at that point, I'm drinking every day. And I hate the way that I feel because I know what I just had. And there's no way to get that back. I'm absolutely incapable of living a life that I want to live. And when I was around 20 years old, I got my first felony charges. And I run and I check myself into treatment, right? And, you know, whatever I can do to continue to do the things I'm doing to get away with it. And I go and I check myself into treatment, and again, you know, I string together a couple months. During my, you know, my bouts of treatment, you know, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was. I didn't understand the importance of why these people continue to go. But what I did was I'd go there with the treatment, and I'd sit in the back and I'd cross my arms. And quite frankly, most of the time I'd be on my phone, and you know, what you people were saying went in one ear and out the other. When I got in trouble about 20 years old, I decided to get a sponsor. I had no idea what that meant. I just knew that I wanted to have a sponsor, so I can say that I had a sponsor. So I asked this woman to sponsor me, and I never met with her, and I never called her after that. And I never went back. My life continued to get worse. I tried the geographical change. You know, I skipped state and I went to Colorado because that's going to fix it, right? And it's always, I'll be happy when I get this, or if I go there, I'm going to be okay. And so I skip state and I go to Colorado, and I'm like, this is it, right? But little did I know that I brought myself with me. And I go down there, and it's the same thing, different story. Same story, different place. And I go down there, and eventually, you know, I'm coming back up to North Dakota, and I'm continuing to get in legal trouble, and my charges are stacking up upon me. My probation officer has no idea what to do with me. At this point, you know, I'm facing prison time. And I'm just, and I live in this delusion, right, that I'm not hurting anyone. And I was absolutely dying inside, and death was always an option. And at that point in my life, I'm about 21 years old, and death is welcome, right? And that's the goal. Because I never lived another life. And I didn't know that there was anything beyond what I knew. And that's what I was stuck in. And so, you know, often there was many suicide attempts on the table, and a few that I came extremely close to. And I'd come out of these things and I'd wake up, and, you know, my family would be hopeful that, you know, maybe I'll get the help I need. And I go back to what I know immediately because I hate the way that I feel. And I can't even kill myself, right? And then me. And eventually I, you know, my parents, during this time, you know, my parents were, my biggest enablers. I'd go to jail and they'd bond me out. And I'd go back to what I knew, and I was getting brought in on, you know, all sorts of different things. And eventually, right, it got to a point where it's like, no one's going to bail me out. I was not only facing state time, I was federally indicted, and I was facing a substantial amount of federal prison time for some crimes that I had committed under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And I remember that day, and I remember telling myself, at least I can get what I need to get in order to feel the way that I need to feel, and I'll worry about the consequences later. and how absurd, right? And I can sit back and I can look at that. And that's what my life had come to. There was very few times that I drew a sober breath. And so I'm sitting in county jail and I'm facing, you know, a substantial amount of, you know, prison time. There's nothing no one can do for me. You know, I'm left with myself for a long enough period to do enough thinking where it's like, is this the kind of life that I want? And I came to a realization, right, that there's three options for me. You know, I can continue doing what I'm gonna what I want to do, and my parents are gonna bury me. I'm gonna spend the rest of my life in prison, or I'm gonna try to find a way out of this, and I'm gonna try to be a better person. And so I do end up getting sentenced to the state pen. During that time, my grandma had passed away, and my grandma was like my biggest role model, right? And I just wanted my grandma to see me sober before she had passed. And this was a woman that I terrorized, and I absolutely hurt immensely doing the things that I was doing. My grandma had passed away, and I applied for this furlough. And I, you know, I went out, and I, when I came back, I had what I brought in things to this, the facility. And that was the last time that I used or put anything into my body. And when I eventually went out to the state penitentiary, and when I was there, what I started to do was I started to take advantage of the programs and the opportunities that they would allow me. Because I knew at this point that I'm either going to continue to do this or I'm going to do something different. And I didn't like the way that I was living. And so there wasn't many AA meetings before I left. They had started one a week. I had an AA book and I had the Sister Fellowship book. But I started going to Bible study. And I believe my spiritual awakening started to happen in the state pen for me. You know, I started to pray, and it wasn't for things that I wanted, right? It was, how can I be a better person? Eventually, I got out of the state pen, and I was getting paroled to the federal government. And my lawyer told me, I told my lawyer, I want to try to go to my mom's house, and he told me that's not an option. You can either go into a sober living home, or you can sit in jail. And I had no idea what I was expecting walking into this sober living home. All I knew at that point was that I wasn't going to be sitting in jail. And I get into that sober living home. And prior to that, you know, I was on, you know, a bunch of medication, and I'm like, this is a problem, right? This medication. And I took myself off of all of it. And I go into this sober living home. And what started to happen was they threw me into recovery, absolutely immersed me. And my second day there, I was going to the Bismarck Big Book Boot Camp. And if you haven't been there, you know, they take you through the book in one day, and it was a lot coming at me. And I remember going back to that sober living home, and I hit my knees and I was bawling because I knew, right, that this is